Hello, I'm Robbie Robertson. This is number 0522, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0522. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Philip Mudd, former deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center and the FBI's National Security Branch. He's also a CNN analyst and the author of BlackSite, the CIA and the Post-9/11 World. Having had a high security clearance means he had to get permission to write this book.
There is a clearance process that's pretty painful for those of us who once were in the service. It's a back and forth that I think is getting increasingly 19th century. I suspect there'll be some changes in it over time because a lot of us are complaining about it. But the other broader issue is the last BlackSite, that is the secret CIA facility for Al-Qaeda prisoners, closed more than a decade ago. And I don't think these will ever exist again in my lifetime. So some of the stuff in there is interesting. And a lot of the people who I interviewed have never spoken before. But in terms of revealing national secret, I don't think so.
Science fiction writer Cadwell Turnbull, whose first book is out. It's called The Lesson, which deals with a race of super advanced aliens on a research mission in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
The Lesson was inspired by a dream that I had when I was in my early 20s. It was aliens had integrated into a small town, and they looked and acted like human beings, except when they got upset, they would kill people. The dream had a profound impact on me, and when I was working on my MFA, I started writing stories set in a world where aliens were like that. Aliens had integrated into society. They were, for the most part, normal, but they had, like, a really disproportionate response to threats.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0522, was podcaster Robbie Robertson, host of Out of the Blank, which I was recently on as a guest. Thank you very much, Robbie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. And by the way, people can go and find more information about Robbie's podcast by going to our website, thestufffile.com, and clicking on the link for this show, which you just heard Robbie mention, and you'll find the link to Robbie's show, Out of the Blank. Again, thank you very much, Robbie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Doctors at a British hospital said a man whose dentures were missing after a surgical procedure was scanned with an x-ray 8 days later, and they found that the dentures were lodged in his throat. Dr. Harriet Cunniff of James Paget Hospital in Norfolk, England, wrote in the British Medical Journal that the 72-year-old patient returned to the hospital 6 days after surgery to remove a lump in his abdominal wall, complaining of difficulties breathing and swallowing. What, no whistling? An x-ray revealed the man's false teeth, which had been missing since his surgery, were lodged in his throat, causing internal blistering and swelling. The man underwent surgery to remove the false teeth and was released from the hospital again 6 days later. The doctors wrote that the case highlights the risks of leaving dentures in during the administering of anesthesia. Okay, you go under anesthesia and you have teeth. But when you wake up, you don't have teeth. Why would you go home without finding out where your teeth went during surgery? It's not like they could walk off while you were under. Yeah. A man in southern Spain who is a serial mocker of recycling efforts was fined 45,000 euros, that's about $50,000 US, and ordered to retrieve a refrigerator he tossed down a hillside in July. The man was identified from a Twitter video he posted of the refrigerator incident, with the truck he used and its license plate clearly visible behind him. He could also be seen in a different video throwing a washing machine into a ravine in the same area. The truck was registered to a house clearing company from which the man has promptly been fired. In a tit-for-tat, officers later posted video of the man struggling to bring the refrigerator back up the hill. Oh, that's sweet. Revenge is a dish best served cold. And he could have kept it even colder if that refrigerator was working. A woman in a Peter Pan bus called 911 to tell police she had been locked in the bus's luggage bay while trying to get some things from her luggage, and that they were now driving down the highway toward Boston. Connecticut State Police caught up with the bus in Wilmington and rescued the caller. 49-year-old driver Wendy Helena Aberty was arrested and faces charges of reckless endangerment, unlawful restraint, and breach of the peace, and was held on a $2,000 bond. Okay, please tell me that the woman in the luggage compartment is getting a refund. You know, bus seats are uncomfortable at best, but this is going a little too far. 53-year-old Cassandra Brooks went to a Sonic restaurant in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and ordered a hamburger. The allegedly raw beef she was served made her sick. She told Sonic management, and State Farm paid her a $10,207.02 check in a settlement. Then she went to a Webster, Texas Sonic, ordered another hamburger, and made an identical claim. But her statement that she missed work as a Texas prison lieutenant was false, officials say, and her photo of raw beef was recycled from the Louisiana incident. Now Brooks has been indicted for insurance fraud, which could send her back to the Texas prisons for as long as 10 years, and this time not in a lieutenant's uniform. In other words, you may say that she ended up getting a raw deal. Police in Sydney, Australia, had a drug bust land in their laps on July 22nd when an unnamed man slammed a van loaded with 600 pounds of methamphetamine into a patrol car parked outside a suburban police station. The car was empty at the time of the collision. The van sped away from the scene, but police caught up with the 28-year-old driver an hour later and charged him with drug supply and negligent driving. The drugs had an estimated street value of about $140 million. Okay, first rule of criminal activity, keep an eye out for the cops. Slamming into the back of a patrol car while driving millions of dollars of drugs around is an epic fail. A Manchester, New Hampshire woman called police to report that her neighbor had assaulted her, but when officers investigated, they found a tube of vampire blood usually used for Halloween costumes. Now, 20-year-old Christy Benoit is facing charges of giving police a false report and falsifying physical evidence. When police were called to the scene, they spoke with Benoit, who said her neighbor had broken down her door, punched, and scratched her. Police said Benoit had black eyes, plus scratches on her arm and leg. Her shirt had red stains on it. She told officers the assault had caused the black eyes, and she also had a nosebleed. In the home, officers found what they initially thought was blood in the kitchen, living room, and bathroom, plus a coffee table out of place and a broken plate. But after looking at the red fluid on the paper towel and on the floor, police figured out it wasn't blood. They also found a tube of vampire blood and determined that Benoit's eyes had makeup around them. Benoit is scheduled to appear in Hillsborough Superior Court. You know, if you're going to frame a neighbor for a fake beating you've taken, then may I suggest you hire a theater major who can help you with makeup and staging? Just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 49-year-old Alex Bonilla took revenge to an extreme on a man he told police he had caught cheating with his wife in May. On July 14th, Gilchrist County, Florida sheriff's deputy said Bonilla entered a house in the town of Bell, firing a gunshot and forcing a man inside into a bedroom where he tied the man up and, using scissors, cut off his penis, which he then ran away with. Oh my, running with scissors and a penis. Later that day, deputies arrested Bonilla at his place of employment. His bond was set at $1.25 million. The family of the victim declined to comment but said through the sheriff's office that the victim was doing well medically. You know, the word well has a very broad spectrum. It's like the word fine. You have to hear the inflection of how it's said. Yeah. So Alex played Mad Moyle using a pair of scissors. At least he didn't use pinking shears. That would leave the poor guy with a frilly dilly. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Philip Mudd was the deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center and the FBI's National Security Branch, so he knows a thing or two about the war on terror. These days, you've probably seen him as an analyst on CNN. He's also written several books. His latest is Black Site, the CIA in the post-9/11 world. He joins us on the line right now from Virginia. Hi, Philip.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Thanks for being on the program with us. In looking into the topic of your book and talking about black sites, the first thing that comes to mind is this stuff that we should know, that we're allowed to know, and did you have to get any clearances to write this book?
Yes, there is a clearance process that's pretty painful for those of us who once were in the service. We're all required, those of us who serve, to get our books cleared. It's a back and forth that I think is getting increasingly 19th century. I suspect there'll be some changes in it over time because a lot of us are complaining about it. But the other broader issue is, you know, the last black site, that is the secret CIA facility for Al-Qaeda prisoners, closed more than a decade ago. And I don't think these will ever exist again in my lifetime. So I don't think some of the stuff in there is interesting. And a lot of the people who I interviewed have never spoken before. But in terms of revealing national secret, I don't think so.
As you said, the last black site closed 10 years ago, about a decade ago. Who do you feel it was important to write this book for? Who did you want to reach with this information? Because as you know, there was a lot of people who agreed with the idea of the black sites and a lot of people who did not.
Yes. I tried to write it for a wider audience. I tried to make it accessible, readable, not a technician's book. I wanted to reach people on both sides. It's not meant to be a defense. It's meant to be an explanation from a group of people who, many of whom were never interviewed because they won't speak to journalists. And they spoke to me because these are my peers. The book is written in the third person, but a lot of these people, I was there with them. So I wanted to write it just as a general reader's insight into something that most people are never aware of. But I also wanted to write it for the people I spoke to. I thought their story would never be written unless I wrote it. They would never speak. They would never write. And so one day I was running in Memphis, Tennessee, and a light bulb went on and said, maybe I should tell their story. So I did.
You mentioned that this is something that probably won't happen again. Do you feel this was that these black sites were something created of the time they were in? And also, do you think it was hastily put together or well thought out?
They were of the time. I think they're not, this is not only a story of secret CIA facilities. It's an effort to do something that's almost impossible to do, for whether you agree or disagree with what the CIA did. Stepping back in time to experience why they did it, I tried to get a lot of the sense of the time, that the tenseness, that the questions about whether there would be a second wave, a second 9/11, which many CIA people anticipated, the question about whether that would be anthrax, because we had the anthrax letters in the fall of 02, and then the fall of 01, and then we knew Al-Qaeda had an anthrax program. It was just trying to have a reader step back. In terms of hastily, yes. One of the first, there's basically three broad pieces to the book. The first is the difficulty of setting up a program like this, a detention program for an agency that's a spy agency. It's not a prison service. So it was the first stage of the program. The detention program was really rough, I think.
Were you concerned at all, or did you have any thoughts about the backlash that having the black sites got from either members of government or media or the general population?
You mean concern back then?
Concern back then and also in later years.
Back then, we knew that people would have questions about what we did, which is why one of the features of the book is the back and forth over the course of years. not just for the first prisoner in 2002, but over years, the back and forth between the CIA and the Department of Justice to ensure that there was documentation and then more documentation and then more documentation. Everybody knew this was eventually, every secret program I ever participated in was eventually revealed. We knew, and I say we because I was obviously a deputy director of counterterrorism aware of this. We all knew we would be questioned. One minor surprise was the speed with which government turned on the CIA, in particular the members of Congress who had been briefed on the program and then a few years later said, we're really uncomfortable with this. The one who was most, the only one that anybody remembers who was in opposition early on was John McCain because of obviously his experience in Vietnam. But yeah, we were I wouldn't say concerned, aware, cognizant of what would happen, but the speed that town turned around, partly because of the divides of the Iraq War, was pretty stunning.
And we should mention, for those who aren't aware, black sites were doing things like they were involved in sleep deprivation, in waterboarding, the very things that, as you just mentioned, Senator McCain was definitely totally against. Why do you think that those in the House and the Senate did turn on you the way they did, since they were, as you say, briefed as it was going along?
It's not all, you know, this is one of the downsides of the what we call the program, the black site program. It was often referred to just as the program at CIA. We briefed a few people, handfuls of people, because the White House did not want wider briefings. I think some of the senior officials from that time, one of the few regrets they have is not pushing back far harder on the White House to say more congressmen and senators need to know. So some of this was more people learning about it and saying, I'm not comfortable with it. The other part was the speed with which America lost its unity. Again, going back to 02, 03 and the lead up to the Iraq War, the unity that we thought would last for some time on September 12th of 2001 dissipated pretty quickly. So partisanship came about, and finally the decline of threat, which I took as a real sign of success. The fact that people could debate whether what the CIA did was appropriate, to my mind, was ironically partly a measure of CIA and other agencies' successes in having people say, I think we're okay against al-Qaeda, maybe we should reconsider this stuff.
The general population only knows what is told to them, either through their government or what they get through the media. During all that time, there was a certain fear about terrorism. Someone like yourself, who was on the inside, who knows what the threats are, was the general population afraid enough of what was out there, or were things actually worse than the general population knew?
I would say worse. And I say that as someone who's both an optimist and not that excitable. To fast forward, I think we're doing pretty well today, so I'm not a Chicken Little guy. But back then, the population would see that the tip of the iceberg threats, high-end stuff, major arrests. What they would miss was, this was a volume business that I was in. You sit at the table, we called it the threat briefings, every day. At first I was at the CIA and then at the FBI. And the volume of lower level threat information, stuff that Americans didn't see because it was disrupted early, or when the arrest came about, it was not an arrest for terrorism, it was arrest for, you know, something else, drug trafficking or something. The drumbeat for years was pretty intense. So I didn't drive home worrying. I would just sat there saying, I'm just shocked that more hasn't happened. And the final thing I'd say on that is, at least in the early stage, I thought we were losing. That is, in 02, 03, 04, I thought al-Qaeda was winning, which helps give you some of the sense for why the book gets into the darkness of those times. It was intense. We thought that if there was another event, it was on us, and most of us would have bet that there would be another event.
Has it been made difficult, the fact that terrorism today is not necessarily, although its tentacles can be found to be state-sponsored, usually when you're talking about terrorism, you're not talking about a country, but a faction or group of people within a particular region. Does that make things difficult when you're going to war, per se, and you're not going to war with a country?
You know, that's an interesting question. I would put it this way. Major terror groups that have an organization, a hierarchy, are devastating because they have the time and place to plan and space to plan. And they have the expertise, for example, bomb makers who can put together a bomb and train somebody. They have a huge disadvantage, which is a center of gravity that intelligence services and militaries are very good at going after. If you have a headquarters, that's the kind of stuff that CIA and the U.S. military are going to find, like ISIS in Syria. The real challenge comes when you have kind of a metastasized movement that is a bunch of little tiny cancers, cells of three or four people who may communicate a bit on the internet, but there's no center of gravity. So if you're an intelligence professional, who do you try to recruit? Who do you try to find? Where do you try to find informants? What phones are you intercepting? The threat from those people is typically lesser. They're not as sophisticated. They can't take down four aircraft. But in some ways, the danger is higher because you can't intercept them. They're just so dispersed. You can't you can't find 25 cells at once. There's no intelligence service that can do that.
We are talking with Philip Mudd, the former deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center and the FBI's National Security Branch. He's the author of Black Site, the CIA in the Post-9/11 World. We'll continue talking with Philip. We'll take a quick break and come back in just a matter of moments here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Stay tuned.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And this indeed is the Stuff File program, heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. It's also now heard on Spotify. And we're talking with Philip Mudd, who was the deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center and the FBI's National Security Branch. He's also an analyst on CNN, and he's the author of the book Black Site, the CIA in the Post-9/11 World. And nowadays, Philip, especially with what has happened in the news of late, when one talks about terrorism, we seem to be discussing homegrown terrorists. Has that always been a big concern, and is it a bigger concern now than terrorists coming from outside of the United States?
Well, there's two phases of that. The first is the sort of Islamist phase that started happening, I'm going to say five, six, 7 years after 9/11, we started out at the FBI then seeing more people who had never been overseas, who were kind of indoctrinated by the internet. You still see some of those, but even far less than you would have seen 4 or 5 years ago at the height of ISIS. We're seeing now, and you saw this in the tragedies in America recently, this question about right-wing extremists, sort of neo-Nazis or white supremacists. I think that's increasing. That's my sense, and that includes talking to some of my old friends. There is a parallel, though. I mentioned just a moment ago that fighting elements that don't have a center of gravity is harder than fighting people who have a place in a hierarchy that you can target with bombs and with intelligence. These new homegrowns who are obviously not Islamists but are equally dispersed are going to be hard to find, because unless they're part of a group, if you're just sitting in the basement indoctrinating yourself with the internet, how the heck are the intel guys going to find you? And I think that's some of what we're seeing today.
Well, since we're talking about the internet, is it also possible that some of the so-called homegrown terrorists can be indoctrinated by larger groups, if not foreign powers?
Yes. You would be surprised. People have grievances. They're angry with immigrants. They're angry with America. They're angry with Israel. These groups, whether they're right-wing, left-wing, Islamist groups, capitalize on grievances. In 20 years ago, to capitalize on that grievance, you had to see somebody face-to-face typically to indoctrinate them. Today, you can put out videos, as ISIS did and was very successful doing this, and reach someone, and that person then becomes, the word I would use is validated. Oh, somebody recognizes my grievances. They say it's okay to commit an act of violence. That validation, that sense that you're not isolated, that it is okay to go kill people, is devastating, because all of a sudden an individual who may feel like he's a misfit decides he's part of a broader group, and that broader group legitimizes his anger. It is okay to do what you want to do. It's okay to hate America. Go blow something up. So the internet is, I think, forever going to be a place that we have to think about in terms of free speech, because there's going to be radicalization of individuals who hate each other. So do you want hate on the internet, which is a free speech issue, or do you want to try to limit the kinds of things that we're talking about?
As someone who was in the counterterrorism world, and now you are an analyst talking about counterterrorism, and you're also an author, what frustrates you more, or what would frustrate you more, if you were still within the system at the CIA and the FBI, or your situation now, when you have a government that doesn't necessarily listen to its counterintelligence experts?
Well, I would be more frustrated in government. By far. Look, I'm just a color commentator now. I realize my role in life is sort of to comment from the sidelines, sort of like someone at a football game, but I'm not in the game. If you were in the game and seeing the kind of vitriol that I see in Washington, D.C., the attacks on the national security apparatus, see your friends in banking making quadruple what you make when you try to raise two kids in Washington, D.C., one of the most expensive cities in the country. Government salaries aren't low. But you got to remember where we live. Washington is really expensive. And then you have people say that you don't represent America, that you've run amok. That is not a lot of fun. I do what I do now. It's interesting. It's far less difficult than what I once did. And my friends, that would be really frustrating. I'm happier to be on the outside.
It sounds like the way you describe how they're being treated now in the counterintelligence world, those who work in government, seems very similar as to how perhaps Vietnam vets felt when they returned from Vietnam.
That's I've never thought of it that way. That's not the sense I get on streets in America. My friends wouldn't be recognized, but in terms of public reaction, since I do CNN, people come up a lot and just on the street or in a bar or, you know, in the airport, they are universally nice. Every single one of, one or two exceptions, but 999 out of 1,000, they're thankful, they're courteous. So I don't feel like people are reacting. Some of them, I think what's happening in Washington is kind of like a show. You know, sort of like when people go to these rallies, I think they see it as sort of entertainment, not reality. Now, I would say that I have a website that the level of hate mail that comes in and the language people use in hate mail is stunning. It's not surprising. It's stunning. It's just people say things through the anonymity of the internet that gives you a sense of anger in America. And the stuff I get, I'm not even a major player. I'm not even a B grade. I'm like C grade. And the stuff I get is unbelievable.
But it's going,
just people just,
but going back to what you said earlier, it could be outside forces. It could be bots doing that, not necessarily the individuals, although I'm sure there are some.
No, what I'm getting is a personal email.
Okay.
I do not think I'm getting bots. I might see that on Twitter I don't do social media, but I read it sometimes. But in terms of someone finding my website and sending me a personal email after I have a TV appearance, and the email is a direct commentary on a TV appearance, those are personalized by someone who sometimes they come in, you know, after some appearances by the dozen. They are just, there are people sitting out there just angry, and they'll tell you how angry they are, and they'll tell you how they want you to die. I mean, it's just like, really, find something else to do with your life. Go have a beer and settle down, watch a baseball game. My word.
Do you get the feeling that, again, the way the government seems to ignore the counterintelligence community, do you get the feeling that the people who you used to work with are now living in a sort of Joseph Heller catch-22 world?
No. I can see how you might think that, but what I would focus on is the talent at the top of these organizations, you know, regardless of the administration you're involved in, to buffer between a Congress and a White House and the workforce. If you look at the leadership of the CIA, I know the director, she is terrific. I don't know the FBI director, but I know of him. He has an excellent reputation. If you have A, that buffer, and B, I can't give you enough of a sense of the immediacy of the mission when you're hunting North Koreans who are popping off missiles, when you're trying to determine what the Russians are doing with American electoral systems, when you're trying to understand whether the Iranians are enriching nuclear material faster than they're saying. People still, A, have the cover from their leadership to do their jobs, and B, have jobs where they say, this is important for America, and it's really a lot more interesting than my friends who are in accounting. So the jobs are compelling.
Do your friends in the community, are they happy with the book that you've written, Black Site, the CIA in the post 9/11 world?
It's just coming out. I have not talked to a lot of them. There are differences of opinion generally in my world among people who think that we shouldn't. That is what people like me call ourselves, former intel people. We formers shouldn't be out in public. We shouldn't be telling stories. That's not a universal view, and that view has changed even the past 10 or 20 years. I'm sure there are some people, and a couple people declined interviews for the book. That was very uncommon. 95% of the people I asked to interview said sure. I'm sure there are some who don't like it, but that's a dying breed. I did have one of the most heartening days. I had one of the architects and managers of the detention program sent me an email, and he said he thought it was the best understanding of what happened that he'd ever read. He's a serious guy, and I stepped back and said, if you think this characterizes what you saw, I'm happy.
I've got to ask you one more question that deals with something that's in the news these days, and of course that's the mass shootings that take place seemingly too regularly in the United States. I remember going back to last year, you actually broke down a little bit on the air talking about one school shooting. Tell us about that and how it affected you, and how you feel the society is moving along in trying to combat these situations.
Well, thanks for reminding me of that. It was like my worst day. I do TV almost every day, my worst day. I was sitting in a studio after it was on the afternoon of the Broward County shootings. I don't have children. I have 4 siblings and 10 nieces and nephews, some of whom are quite young. And I remember before going on air, I had thinking, what if one of my sisters had to go clear out the closet of a child? And I couldn't escape the image of what these parents were going through and what would happen if my sister called. And so we were going on air, and you know, you have this thing called an IFB, that's your earpiece, and a mic. And I was, before we went out, telling the producer, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can go on. It was very soon after the shooting, like an hour or two. I don't think I can go on air. And he said, give it a try. And then it just, it went south. So it was just, that was, it was embarrassing, but I just couldn't escape the idea of what would happen in my family if something like this occurred. And I sort of sat there wishing that every person would imagine the world that way, so maybe we could have more realistic conversations about what we should do in this country.
Well, trust me, it wasn't your worst day on television as far as I was concerned. I just want to let you know that right now. It was,
thank you.
It was very human. So the second part of my question was, do you think we can get past all of this and things will happen where these shootings will not be as prevalent as they are?
I think so. I wouldn't bet a lot of money on this. For some reason, you know, I've lived in Europe, I've lived in the Middle East, I've spent some time in Asia, I lived in India for a while. For some reason, Americans think that, identify freedom with a gun. I'm not anti, I mean, I have a farm, people shoot deer all the time, I eat venison and turkey that people shoot on my farm. I love venison chili in the fall, but I don't fully understand. When I'd lived overseas, because there are stricter gun control laws, particularly on semi-automatic weapons, I didn't feel less free. But to your, you know, let me give you the way I think about it. If you went into a bar 60 years ago and said to somebody, you can't smoke, that person would have said, it's my right to smoke here. You're impinging on my rights. Over time, smoking became not a right, but a public health issue. And today people say, of course you can't smoke in a bar. It's a public health issue. My sense, and I might be on the fringes on this one, is that people are starting to transition to see shootings as a public health issue and not simply an issue of gun rights. So maybe in 10 years, 20 years, we'll start to see. I'm not saying we should take away people's weapons, but the semi-automatics with high-capacity clips, I just don't. You'll never shoot a turkey with one of those things. I don't get it. I think as this transitions to a public health conversation, it's actually a better place to be.
There's a lot we could talk to you about, including your book, which is Black Site, the CIA and the Post 9/11 World. Philip, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It was most enlightening to have a chance to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. That was more interesting than I expected. Thanks a lot.
Philip Mudd, author of Black Site, the CIA and the Post 9/11 World. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0522, and you'll find links to Philip's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Lesson. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And much more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Okay, 44-year-old Jennifer Armstrong was charged with public intoxication and theft of wine, €8 worth, from a supermarket in Dublin, Ireland. She pleaded guilty but asked the judge for one last chance. Armstrong is homeless, and she'd been released from prison with no money. She goes out on the street, her lawyer said, and turns down the only avenue she knows. She went quickly, too. Her new arrest came a mere 2 days after her release. The alcoholic was deemed a proper candidate for day programs, and Judge Carol Ann Cooligan gave her a suspended sentence. The conviction was Armstrong's 648th. Wow. What I want to know is what number last chance was it? Eesh. And speaking of courthouses, why did attorney Adam Wirtz get a trespassing charge for going to the Will County, Illinois courthouse? Perhaps because he left at about 1 a.m. Perhaps because the building is still under construction. Or maybe his manner of departure was the problem. He jumped from the top with a parachute. It can't have helped that he landed in the parking lot of the institution across the street from the courthouse, the Joliet Police Department. When I first read about this in the paper, said County Judge Corey Lund, who sentenced Wirtz on the latter's guilty plea, I thought to myself, that has to be the stupidest person I've ever met. Along with a $600 fine and a year of supervision, Wirtz's sentence includes 50 hours of community service at an animal shelter and another 50 hours helping people without the resources to pay lawyers. Yeah, that sounds like a plan. because the poor deserve the legal counsel of the stupidest person the judge has ever met. Yeah. 61-year-old Larry Adams of Daytona Beach, Florida, came out swinging late on August the 12th, complaining that neighbors were playing their music too loudly in the parking lot of their apartment complex. Adams emerged from his apartment threatening to shoot them and brandishing nunchucks, which he then hit himself in the head with. Police officers responding to a 911 call said that Adams also sprayed everyone with roach repellent, causing them to cough and their skin to burn. Adams, sporting a goose egg on his forehead, was charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. I'm sure if it weren't for the bug spray, the victims would have been crying tears of laughter after watching Adams hit himself in the head with nunchucks. That's classic comedy right there. Yeah. And a 20-year-old woman called the police saying her car had been stolen while running from police in an attempt to trick them into thinking that she wasn't the one driving her car during the chase. It did not end well. According to Clinton County Sheriff Rick Lincoln of Iowa, on August 13th at around 10:38 a.m., a deputy sheriff was on patrol on Highway 30. The deputy clocked an eastbound vehicle on radar exceeding the speed limit. When the deputy attempted to perform a traffic stop on the speeder, the driver sped off and ran a red light before pulling into a parking lot. The driver then exited the parking lot and fled westbound. While the pursuit was in progress, Clinton County Communications received a 911 call from a Rachel Thornburg stating that her car had just been stolen. She claimed that she had left the keys in the car, which was a 1998 gray Buick Century. This was the same vehicle that the deputy sheriff was pursuing. The pursuit continued with the driver running more stop signs. LeClaire police attempted to stop the car by deploying stop sticks, but were unsuccessful. Eventually, the Iowa State Patrol was able to successfully deploy stop sticks that flattened the tires of the Buick. The pursuit ended almost an hour after it began at 11:29 a.m. just north of Interstate 80 in Scott County. Rachel was charged with eluding, driving while license was under suspension, of course, reckless driving, and speeding. Aren't we forgetting making a false 911 call? That's usually a crime, too. Plus, she's only 20 and she already has a suspended license. Yeah, this girl's future is not looking too bright. And neither is she. A Nashville man was arrested for what started out as an alleged shoplifting attempt that turned into charges of assaulting an officer. Police were already at the Walmart on another call, because everything happens at Walmart, when, while in the loss prevention office, they observed John Allen Honaker on security camera shoving items in his pants. Police and the loss prevention employee detained the man and discovered he had placed two propane bottles in his pants, along with sliced beef brisket. The total value of the items found in Honaker's pants is approximately $35. Walmart asked to prosecute Honaker for shoplifting, because Walmart don't play. So police began transporting him to central booking. While on the way, Honaker tried kicking out the windows of the police vehicle, as well as spitting a number of times inside and slamming his head against the plastic partition separating the rear and front seats. After the officer called for backup assistance, police said they attempted to place a hobble restraint on Honaker to prevent his attempts to causing more damage to the police vehicle. That's when Honaker allegedly attempted to kick the officer in the head and midsection. Police say he had a strong odor of alcohol about his person, admitted to officers he had been drinking, and advised officers to leave his drunk, bleeping bleep alone. Honaker was arrested on a Class B misdemeanor charge of assault on an officer. Who knew that someone who was intoxicated and with a brisket down their pants had so much fight in them? Wow. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Cadwell Turnbull is a science fiction writer. He has written many short stories for a variety of publications, but he's just released his first novel. It's called The Lesson, and it deals with a race of super advanced aliens on a research mission who arrive in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Cadwell joins us via Skype from Boston to talk about The Lesson. Hi, Cadwell.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, when you talk to writers, especially first-time writers, I'm sure you always heard the old axiom, write what you know. Now, I know you're originally from the U.S. Virgin Islands, so I now have to ask, what do you know about aliens?
Just watching TV growing up, watching Alien, First Contact, TV shows, movies, that kind of thing.
Reading books.
Yeah.
Tell us about the story of The Lesson.
So The Lesson was inspired by a dream that I had when I was in my early 20s. It was aliens had integrated into a small town, and they looked and acted like human beings, except when they got upset, they would kill people. And the dream had a profound impact on me. And when I was working on my MFA, I started writing stories set in a world where aliens were like that. Aliens had integrated into society. They were, for the most part, normal, but they had like a really disproportionate response to threats. And I decided to set it in the Virgin Islands.
Now, as I mentioned, you were originally from the U.S. Virgin Islands. You've set the story there, but is there any other reason besides that fact that you're from there that you set the story there? Because I'm bringing up a theory here, and it's the fact that, you know, my family is also originally from the West Indies, and most of those areas were colonial holdings. In the case of the U.S. Virgin Islands, it still is. Does that add a certain level to the story because of that historical aspect?
Absolutely. When I first started working on it, I wasn't thinking about that exactly, but as soon as I started writing stories set there, that theme became, pretty obvious, and I decided to explore it as deeply as I could. So there's scenes where you see characters in Danish colonial history, and I make parallels to the Danish slave society and the Ina occupation.
And Ina is the, those are the aliens, right?
Yes, yeah, those are the aliens.
Now, this is your first novel. As I said in the introduction, you've written several short stories in the past. How much of a leap was this to go from what you've written in the past to doing a full-fledged novel?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I started the novel as short stories. So when I was in my MFA, I wanted to write something close to home and practice the mechanics of short story writing. And the first story I wrote was set in this world, but it was very different than how it showed up in the novel. But over time, when I was writing short stories that would eventually become The Lesson, my MFA advisors told me that this is a novel, you should write a novel. And I resisted for a long time because novels were intimidating. I was writing short stories for quite a while. And then once I realized that the short stories were telling a larger story and they were connecting to some larger plot, I decided to think and be intentional about it being more of a novel. And it took me time to work it into something that looked like a novel.
Was it difficult for you to get over that intimidation factor, the idea of writing a full novel?
It was until I realized that I'd written enough stories for it to be at least half of a novel. And then I was like, okay, I've written enough of this that I shouldn't be intimidated by doing the rest.
Now, are the people, as you say, it's a super advanced race of aliens that are among the population that look like the population. Is the population aware of the fact that there are aliens?
Yes, absolutely. The Ina, despite looking like humans, have a way of carrying themselves that makes them obviously not. So they carry themselves they're kind of jerky in their movements, that's for one. But they also have a sort of aloof superiority that other islanders will notice as not being one of them, not a local islander, and not a tourist. And so when they see an Ina, they almost immediately recognize them as such.
when people talk about science fiction, they often relay the fact that what is happening in science fiction is just really an allegory for the times we live in generally. Would you say your book, The Lesson, has that similar tone to it?
Yes, in a lot of ways. I mean, some of it was I really wanted to write about aliens and I thought it was cool. And so when I started it, it was like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to write this alien story where the aliens look like people and they live in the Virgin Islands? And then over time, and I think, you know, a lot of writers will say this, over time, you start making parallels to the real world and you start thinking about, oh, what does this mean to the people that are experiencing this world that you've devised? And how are they responding to it? And what are they relating it to in their own minds? And so, of course, because they're people, they'll relate it to things that we consider to be normal within our lives. So there's a lot of parallels to faith, exploration of sexuality, belief, power, these things that we think about all the time as people. Even if aliens are there, people are going to be thinking about that, and they're going to be thinking about the aliens in relation to that. So in that sense, yes.
We're talking to you. You're in Boston right now. Do you still have family in the U.S. Virgin Islands?
Yes, my mom lives there. My sister lives there. My niece, my cousins, my aunts and uncles. A ton of people and friends. And I go there all the time. I visit, and I have a family home there that I go back to regularly.
As a writer, be it writing short stories or, in this case, your first novel, some of the harshest critics you'll find are your family. I'm just wondering what they think of the book, especially considering the setting is where they live.
Yeah, not really that. I didn't get that much pushback from my family, per se. I had an uncle. My uncle was reading the book, and he remarked on the fact that I had rice and beans as the staple within the book. And he was like, we don't say that, we say peas and rice. And so I got the order mixed up. And he was very adamant about that being terrible and that I needed to fix it. And I had some other people point out the fact that I had a character go down a street and they turned in the wrong direction. So things like that. So like, you can't turn left there, you have to turn right.
Well,
that sort of thing.
As every West Indian knows, it's always peas and rice.
Right.
now that you have this book out, one of the things that, of course, a lot of writers never really understand when they first start writing the book, which is a very solitary job, you do it in seclusion, is that when you produce the book and you put it out there, you've got to go out and promote the book like you're doing now. How have you handled the idea that you're going to have to go out now and promote this book?
It's been interesting. It's definitely a part that I didn't think about when I was working on the book. And now that I had to do it, it's been a learning experience. Every situation is different and new. And I find myself within each situation trying to figure out how to navigate it. But as I'm doing it, I'm starting to, you know, develop the muscle for it. And so it's hopefully by the end of the tour, I have I still have a few more places that I need to go for the book. I'll be feeling like this is comfortable and I could do this again for the next book.
And still with this one, first of all, do you know what your next book is about already?
Yeah, I'm actually working on it and it's due fairly soon. It's called No Gods, No Monsters, and it's contemporary fantasy that I pitch as a retelling of the civil rights era, but with monsters from Caribbean and popular folklore.
Wow, that sounds very interesting indeed. Now, when putting this book together, or when writing this particular book, The Lesson, did you ever envision the idea that maybe this would make an interesting movie? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, The Lesson is actually optioned by AMC. It's the TV channel.
Right.
And it's in development. I don't know when it's going to be in production. I don't know any of that stuff yet, but they're working on it, and I'm excited to see what they do.
Well, congratulations on getting the deal with AMC, and congratulations for putting out your first book, The Lesson. Cadwell, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
Cadwell Turnbull, author of the science fiction novel, The Lesson. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0522, and you'll find links to Cadwell's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. And thanks to Stufffile program listener and Patreon patron Shell Beckwith for suggesting that we have Cadwell on the show. It's much appreciated. You're listening to the Stufffile program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stufffile presents the idiot of the day.
A man implicated himself in a crime when he signed thief on the receipt after using a stolen credit card. 28-year-old Mark Lattimore inked a receipt after purchasing several items with a stolen credit card. Lattimore stole the card from a woman who told police she gave him a ride. He allegedly used the card to purchase a cell phone for $200. When he signed the receipt, he wrote thief where he should have put his name. He also signed as thief at the Butler Beer and Tobacco store after spending $42 on beer and cigarettes. Once the card was reported stolen, Butler police found Lattimore on their database after he matched the description from the victim. They identified him on video surveillance tapes from both stores. Officers further confirmed his identity when they called him on the phone he purchased with the stolen card. Lattimore was charged with receiving stolen property and theft by deception. Now, why? Oh, why would you steal someone's credit card, use it in several locations, and sign your name as thief on the receipts? And how can you allow the cops to question you by calling the cell phone you just bought with said stolen credit card? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stufffile program number 0522. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stufffile page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0522. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stufffile program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.